Gracious and loving God, I thank you so much again for this opportunity to be in this place, come together and to worship you, to study your word, to sing songs of your grace and peace towards us. Thank you for the word that was read for us this morning, and I ask that any words that I share would be edifying to our hearts and souls and lives. In Christ's name, amen. So for the last few weeks, the lectionary readings have provided us with the opportunity to step back and sort of explore the nature of God's call, to look at the privilege of that call, the blessings of that call, and the purpose of that call. So in the first sermon on the nature of our call as individuals and our call together as a people, because this is very much so a corporate reality as well, I focused on the privilege of being called. When you look at the words in Isaiah and Jeremiah, as I said, there's this grand, beautiful poetry that is used to describe this privilege. That this God who created stars and planets and the earth and animals and us, and this majestic, powerful, amazing God has called me. And when Isaiah does it, you see the greatness and the majesty of this God and the smallness of Isaiah and Jeremiah. And what an awesome and amazing privilege that is, to think that this great, amazing God actually wants to partner with little old, frail, flecked, flawed me to reach into this world. What a privilege. And we went on from there in the second sermon. We talked about the blessing. And in Luke, the blessing is very much so focused on these different states of existence. Whether it was someone who was hungry or grieving or poor. And the focus is how God blesses them in a way that directly satisfies that deep felt need that they have, thus releasing them and empowering them to serve. When you look in Matthew goes a step further, and he talks about blessing people who aren't necessarily in any sort of compromised state of existence, but have certain virtues and gifts like mercy and peacemaker, and God uses those and empowers them. And so some of the blessing is a direct blessing to us in terms of addressing deep felt needs that we have in life. But the blessing is also about this empowering presence of God that enables us and equips us to then fulfill the call. So the blessing. This morning, I want to make a transition from talking about the privilege and the blessing of the call to the responsibility or the purpose of the call. In other words, I want to look at the content and shape that this call takes in terms of our purpose. In the Gospels, especially in the Sermon on the Mount and in Luke's Sermon on the Plain, which is what the passage was read for us this morning is from, when the transition is made from the call, which we saw in Luke 5, or you see in Matthew 4, when the transition is made from the call to the blessing to the purpose or the responsibility, the focus in the Gospels is almost universally on the issue of love. So it goes from a call narrative, whether it's the classic one in Matthew 4 or Luke 5 or all the different call narratives that we see in the Gospels, to the blessing. It goes almost immediately, universally, to this issue of love. And part of what I want to suggest before we go any further is that the most basic fundamental aspect of our calling is to love. to love God, to love one another, to love our neighbor. And then we'll see how Matthew and Luke, they push it way, way out there to loving enemies. But it's love. And it's not just in the Gospels that we see this. It's fascinating to me that both in Corinthians and especially in Romans, when Paul addresses the issue of call and blessing and purpose, he follows this exact same pattern. So look at 1 Corinthians 12. That's where you see Paul addressing this reality of how we are called. And as a result of this call, this what would could feel like just this immense burden. Here's little old me with all my flecks and flaws, and I'm being called to do this. No, I can't do that. I'm not capable. I'm not able. I can't do that. But then Paul immediately talks about what? The gifts of the Spirit. And how God calls us, and then through the gifts, God empowers us to be able to fulfill the calling. And what comes right after 1 Corinthians 12? 1 Corinthians 13, which is all about what? Love. Now, unfortunately, we tend to look at 1 Corinthians 13 almost exclusively in the context of weddings. And unintentionally, we take it out of its context and we have this intuitive sense that it's about marriage. And of course it is to a degree about marriage. Of course it is. But first and foremost, it's about what we're called to. So Paul goes from the call to the blessing to the fundamental, most basic purpose of this call, love. When you look at Romans 12, Paul does pretty much exactly the same thing. He talks about the call. He talks about the blessings of the Spirit to fulfill the call. And then he talks about love. Love God. Love your brothers and sisters. Love your neighbor. Love the stranger. Love your enemies. Love. So the absolute most basic purpose, content, shape of the call is to love. And I think it's fair to say that as long as we're exercising that in its multiplicity of form and nature, we're fulfilling our call. If we've been called to be a Sunday school teacher, and we're doing that in love, whether it's for wee little ones or folks with, you know, less hair that's graying, that's love. It's fulfilling that call. If it's reaching out to one's neighbor who's hurting and distressed, it's love. So the most basic fundamental reality of the purpose of our call is to love. Now, in the Gospels and in Paul's writings as well, but especially in the Sermon on the Mount and in the Sermon on the Plain, the focus is on the indiscriminate nature of love. The indiscriminate nature. Which in essence means that irregardless of gender, nationality, culture, race, class, orientation, social acceptability-ness, I don't even think that's a word, but whether you're clean or unclean, whether you're in or out, you know, whatever it might be, irregardless of any factor that we use to kind of put people in groups so that we can then isolate them off and put up barriers and not necessarily love them. That's what it means to discriminate, to put them in something that we don't have to, you know, extend this love to them. Any and all of those by Jesus are demolished. Think of all the factors we use to discriminate between people and assign value to them. Those factors keep us from loving other people. In the Gospels, Jesus systematically challenges the grounds for discriminating against certain people and therefore justifying not loving them, and calls us to a universal love that is fundamentally indiscriminate in nature. To make his point about the indiscriminate nature of love that we are called to live, Jesus goes to the very extreme, the unreasonable extreme, the irrational extreme. So fundamentally irrational and unreasonable that I would suggest to you the church has spent 2,000 plus years trying to reinterpret it. And that fundamental extreme is to love enemies. Because in their culture and in their time, hating enemies was a justifiable calling. It was expected. It was actually your responsibility. The Jewish people had so completely reinterpreted many of these passages in the Old Testament that they actually taught that love for your neighbor was restricted to people who were Jewish like you. And everybody outside of that, you could hate. Even and especially enemies. And what we see Jesus doing is recognizing that in human nature, it's almost a fundamental given that we hate enemies. We hate those who insult us. We hate those who persecute us. We hate those who harm us. It's justifiable. It's reasonable. It's rational from a human perspective. And so Jesus goes to that place where the vast majority of people would say that is okay. And he fundamentally undermines it and challenges it. And when you read it in Luke, you know, Matthew, like an accountant, likes to organize everything in their six little sayings and all that kind of stuff. Luke just boom, 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 every possible conceivable way that this person could hurt you, harm you. Love, 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 love. Makes it almost virtually impossible to get around it and away from it. So by pushing this concept of loving all the way out to our enemies, it should make it pretty clear that that neighbor who's kind of annoying should be an object of our love. That boss who's a bit overbearing should be an object of our love, etc. Now, Jesus' and Paul's call to love enemies has been throughout the history of the church one of the primary dividing points between different faith denominational groups. And I want to explore just the classic position. And when I say the classic position, this is where it was at one point in time, but it may be more nuanced and different today, and I acknowledge that. But this would be considered the classic position of how different groups have interpreted the Sermon on the Mount and the Sermon on the Plain, specifically relative to loving enemies. And one of the things that's very fascinating to me is that almost all of them say Jesus was teaching nonviolence. But who does it apply to and how? So in traditional Roman Catholicism, very much so affirmed that Jesus was teaching the ethic of nonviolence. But that ethic applied to priests, nuns, monks, the rest of the body, the church, lived according to natural law, not the ethic of Jesus. Okay. Luther took umbrage with that and said, yes, Jesus is teaching the ethic of nonviolence, but Nelson, you can remember this from our conversations, wonderful conversations we had with the Lutheran Church and that whole partnership time. But when you're in the kingdom of God, you live according to the ethic of nonviolence. When you're in the kingdom of the world, you live according to natural law or the ethics of the world. It's called the two kingdom theory. Okay, so it's limited in terms of its application. Calvin came along and said, we live in the spirit of this, but we don't necessarily live it in reality. Okay, and Calvin never got much coverage with that because everybody kind of scratched their head and said, you didn't say that about adultery or any of these other six sayings, just this one. So Calvin, outside of his writings, never got a whole lot of dispensationalists, that powerful Christian movement, evangelical fundamentalist movement that began in the 1920s in this country. Dispensationalism very much so affirmed that Jesus was clearly teaching an ethic of nonviolence. But it had to do with the end times, not now. During this time, this dispensation, you live according to the ethics of the Old Testament. In the end times, you'll live according to what Jesus said. Now, somebody, in my opinion, forgot to tell Paul and Stephen and a few others who lived it out in their time. But that's just my neo-evangelicals, like a good friend of mine, Craig Blomberg. He said Jesus is teaching an ethic of nonviolence. But it's bilateral, not unilateral. So if Nelson attacks me, I have to respond nonviolent because Nelson's attacking me. But Catherine could attack Nelson to protect me. And of course, everybody says, well, somebody forgot to tell Jesus and Peter and that whole thing about relative to that issue. See, and the point is, what we're looking at historically is an absolute watershed passage that has divided groups in terms of how they understand we live out this faith in the world today. In our own tradition, and you may have noticed it, I came across this call to worship that Roddy Hamilton wrote. I just absolutely love this thing, because it gets at this distinction between what's called non-resistance and non-violent resistance, okay? Non-resistance, in essence, the enemy loved them, the oppressor walked the mile with them, the master turned the other cheek, this doormat faith. That's his ever so gentle shot across the bow about non-resistance. And he's suggesting that obviously that's not how he thinks it should be interpreted and understood, that it's non-resistance. In other words, other than perhaps praying, you don't do anything. Okay. Nonviolent resistance is a form of resistance, but it's nonviolent. And that's sort of the difference that you see in Anabaptism. More recently, Anabaptism has reinterpreted much of this in terms of nonviolent resistance as opposed to non-resistance. And a lot of that has to do with how they understand these three key sort of realities. And much of it is steeped in a historical, critical understanding of the times and what this actually meant in their time. And the three are turning the other cheek, going the extra mile, and when you get sued for your cloak. Okay? So the first one, turning the other cheek. In their culture at their time, it was acceptable for somebody who had higher status than another person to slap them quite often with a glove or with the back of their hand across their cheek. When that happened, you as the lower station status person were supposed to bow and withdraw. That's what you were supposed to do. Jesus says, show them the other cheek. Because now they have to potentially strike you with the unacceptable hand. And you're challenging, in essence, their right to do that. You're showing them the other cheek because they could only do that with, I think it was the right hand on the left cheek or the left hand, whichever one it was, it doesn't matter. But they could only do that. Anything else crossed the line in terms of what they could do in that situation. And you're, in essence, disarming them by turning the other cheek. It is defiance. It is resistance, but it's fundamentally nonviolent. Okay, and I'm going to give you a contemporary illustration of this in a second. The second one, getting sued for the cloak. In Matthew, it's clear that the person is hauled into court, and that's what it's about, and they're getting sued. And they take your cloak, Matthew, Jesus, and Matthew and Luke says, give them your shirt too. Because now you're exposing the injustice of this law that allows them to actually take the cloak, which could be the only thing you have that keeps you warm at night. So give them your shirt too. Now you're going to have your loincloth on. You're not standing there buck naked. But it would have exposed the whole reality of the injustice of that law. Going the extra mile. That one gets perverted all the time in our culture. Got car dealerships saying, we'll go the extra mile. You know, all that sort of stuff. It's just an absolute perversion. And that perversion really weakens the meaning of the passage. It's a serious thing, in my opinion. But going the extra mile was what a Roman soldier could demand that you do. But they could not, under any circumstances, make you go farther than that. So by going the extra mile, you're actually flipping the narrative, the power narrative on them, and they're now begging you to give that pack back. Because they can get themselves in hot water if you carry that more than a mile. So it's resistance. It's calling attention to an injustice, but doing it in a fundamentally nonviolent way. So two quick illustrations. And I know I've shared this one with you a long time ago, at least in my mind, I sort of think I did. But if I sort of think I did, you've probably long since forgotten about it by now. So F.D. de Klerk, who was one of the orchestrators and definitely the primary sustainer of apartheid in South Africa. And we know that post-Holocaust, what was going on in South Africa in terms of apartheid was a significant, significant racial injustice and oppression and genocide. And we know that more and more now than we even knew then. But they had a pretty good idea of it in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And MCC, the Knight Central Committee, along with several other groups, went into South Africa to actually start training them in the fine art of nonviolent resistance. In South Africa, white males could spit in the face of a black male or a black woman. And it was a sign of their power and their authority and their right. And the person of color had absolutely no recourse whatsoever. So Mennonite Central Committee started pondering along with different groups, you know, how are we going to teach them to respond to this. Quite often it was intentionally done when that white male or female had children with them to reinforce the power structure of apartheid by shaming the black mother or father by spitting in their face. Their solution or their suggestion, their idea was pick up your child and invite them to do it to you. F.W. de Klerk tells the story of how he was walking from one building to another outside in Johannesburg, and he came upon a black grandmother who did laundry in that neighborhood, and he spit in her face. And for two blocks, she walked backwards, repeating over and over again, "Oh, please, for my grandson too, please. Oh, please, for my grandson too. Oh, please, for my grandson too." Continuing to keep her grandson right up in his face. F.W. de Klerk, the president of South Africa, said his reaching out to Nelson Mandela, his work for peace that almost got him assassinated on several occasions, was directly motivated by that grandmother who responded with nonviolent resistance. He said for weeks and months after that, he could not get the image of that child out of his head. And how she just kept putting money for the child, please. Child, please. He couldn't get it out of his head. It completely disarmed him. It completely shamed and humiliated him. And he, the architect and sustainer of apartheid, became one of the fundamental leaders in dismantling. Because of the act of one elderly woman to disarm him through nonviolence. That's nonviolent resistance. One more quick story. So I was at Lowe's this week, which seems to be actually this Home Depot, which I make a weekly run on Fridays to figure out what I do for the weekend to do the honeydew list satisfaction. And I was there, and I was standing in line, and you know, I had my mask on, and I noticed this rather burly fellow, a couple of people in front of me in the line, mocking this elderly gentleman who was just trying to check out in an honest way. His hands were shaking. He was clearly, and he was mocking him and riding him as he was wearing. And I sat there for a little bit. I had my mask. I don't want to exaggerate my bravery, okay? I had 140 plus pounds of muscle and teeth, i.e. my dogs. So you know, I wasn't particularly compromised here. But finally, I just said, "Hey, buddy, he's not bothering you. Just leave him alone. Just leave him alone." And of course, now the target's on me. And he went on a rant about how I was a sheep following the liberal propaganda and all this sort of stuff. And you know, that mask was absolutely no guarantee for you, COVID. And a lot of other choice things I wouldn't repeat in any context, especially here from the sacred pulpit. But I waited for him to pause and come up for breath. And I said, "Well, you know, you're really right about a couple of things." And I could tell immediately, "What?" So yeah, "You're really right." I said, "I am a sheep. And I follow the great shepherd, Jesus. So yeah, I am a sheep. And I'm okay with that." Said, and secondly, you're right. This is no guarantee that I'm not going to get COVID. I said, as a matter of fact, recent evidence suggests that it's more of a guarantee that I won't give it to you than it'll keep me from getting it from you or someone else. And I said, you know, Jesus talks about loving your enemies, putting the other first. And so I wear this to put you first and to express love. Because, yeah, you're right. The evidence does suggest it protects you more than it protects me. He stood there for a second. His buddies who were with him said, Larry, let's go. And they went out to their vehicles and left. Never saw the little old man. I don't even know when he got out of there, but he got out of there fast. He wasn't there when I finished. I kind of looked around. He was already long gone. Okay. But I don't think it's about non-resistance. I think there are places where interpreting this at a level of complete non-resistance is probably right. That's why I wouldn't go as far as Roddy Hamilton of making fun of it. But I think that generally speaking, the approach that we're called to, our calling, is one of nonviolent, loving resistance, but definitely love, love, love. So you remember that very short sermon I gave? Love God, love one another, love the other. And I went and sat down, everybody. Okay. That's where we're at.